Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Ham Nation is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This episode of Ham Nation is brought to you by DX Engineering. DX Engineering offers practically everything you need to outfit your shack, plus the fastest shipping in the industry. In-stock items ship the same day, Monday through Friday until 10 p.m. Eastern. For more information, visit DXEngineering.com/HamNation. And by ICOM. For more information, visit ICOMAmerica.com/HamNation.
This is Ham Nation, episode 255 for July 6, 2016. CW and Dr. T Live. Good evening. Welcome to another episode of Ham Nation. I'm George, W5JDX. Bob is not with us tonight. He's on the road, but we've got a cast of regulars in here tonight. To my south, just a little bit, our good friend Don Wilbanks.
I'm more irregular than regular of late, but you don't want to hear about my diet. No, we've got a good show tonight. We've got Dr. T with the solar update, and as a special treat, we have Dr. T live tonight, and she will be hanging out to the end of the show for your chat room questions. So Amanda will be in with the chat room, so be sure and get your questions ready for Dr. Scove, your solar weather questions. So we're going to have a good show tonight, George.
Sounds hot, Don. I think we've got Val.
Thank you. Yep. Try the veal. Yep.
Hey, you just set them up. I'll knock them over. We've got Val with us tonight, too. What are you going to be talking about tonight, Val?
Oh, you know what? I was going to say, if Don's regular, I'm only on every other week. Does that make me like bi-monthly regular? I don't know. But I'm going to be talking about CW. And we've been frantically busy in the shack getting ready for something, and I'm going to tell you all about that in my segment later. So, and you know what? Friday, I don't know if you guys remember, back in Dayton, we interviewed Tom, who was cycling around the world. He's a ham radio operator, and he's been cycling all over the world. Well, he just left Ethiopia on a plane to Egypt, and I'm going to be pre-recording an interview with him Friday from Egypt about his travel. So that's something to look forward to in a couple of weeks.
Okay. Sounds like a lot of fun, Val. We'll be looking for that here shortly. And, of course, from Costa Mesa, we've got Gordo and his infamous short shots.
Well, good afternoon to all and good evening to all. I have the Hawaiian shirt on because listen to this. Well, I know it's a little scroungy CW, but 2,500 miles, a new record was set on 902 megahertz 3 days ago from N6NB. Dr. Wayne Overbeck makes the contact with Hawaii. He goes to Hawaii and makes it over here on UHF. Amazing. Many of us also had a great opportunity to work Hawaii. But let's jump back and tune in to Dan, N9 Lima Victor Sierra, the Fox Cities Amateur Radio Club, and see what they did for CW and activities last week at Field Day. Here's Dan.
The Foxes Amateur Radio Club held their Field Day at the Greenville Grange in Greenville, Wisconsin. Construction of the Field Day site started about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The main tent, an SSB tent, went up rather quickly. The CW station was housed in a utility trailer, and the GOTA station, quite frankly, just drove up. We used multiple antennas this year at Field Day. Here's our phased 40-meter vertical dipoles, as well as an inverted V and a multiband vertical for the sideband station. For the CW station, we ran a multiband dipole. And for the GOTA station, we ran a multiband coil dipole. As it started getting closer to 1 o'clock, the parking lot started to fill up. Well, after a quick strategy meeting and a few double checks on the generators, we were ready to go. Well, the sideband station started out quite well and made quite a few contacts right off the bat, as well as the CW station. The numbers coming out of the CW station were amazing. And the GOTA station got its workout as well. Shortly after the start of field day, the Boy Scouts showed up to get their merit badge. We had quite the array of stuff for them to do. Well, the sideband station kept making contacts and breaking through those pileups. And the CW station kept hitting that brass and driving our contact numbers well into 300. As we started getting near nightfall, reports of storms coming our way. We continued to operate until almost 3 a.m. Well, the storm got very intense, so we had to shut down. The radar looked pretty ominous. By the next morning, most of the antennas were partially underwater, as well as the tent and the station itself were all partially underwater. It was even hard to retrieve the generator off in the distance. Nothing a pair of shorts and some bare feet can't handle. So after retrieving the equipment and setting it up by a table, we got on the multiband vertical, and the sideband station was up and running again. And the CW station continued to run, as they were mostly out of the water. The Fox City's Amateur Radio Club sees field day as more of a social event, getting together with fellow hams and making some contacts as we go along. Even though we had the rain, it was still a successful event. 7-3s from the Greenville Grange in Greenville, Wisconsin, from the Fox City's Amateur Radio Club.
Whoa, good job, Dan, and the Fox team, Fox City's ARC. Mentioned so many times was CW. And speaking of CW, this is a trick here that we learned something from the kids. So, Brian, if you'll go ahead and roll the short shots on CW. Well, we've seen a lot of different types of CW keys, a lot of different methods for learning CW. We hope many of you will adopt the Farnsworth method, where the letters are spaced apart but sent at about 13 to 15 character rate. That's what I do on the 8 CDs that I produce for the W5YI group. And that's CW in the background. So no matter what type of key you're using, CW continues to be the mode. And we decided to make some CW key kits for kids. Now, other groups such as Bill, KL7 Bravo Bravo, who makes the CW Palooza workshop keys coming up July 23rd in Auburn, these keys are of a plain old clothespin. And what we use is just a small drill. And that drill is going to go into place to, first of all, keep the front end of the clothespin from skeetering left and right. So we put a pin in the front end. Now, kids love to do this. So don't build the CW keys yourself. Let the kids do it. This is at Pacificon, and you can see they're having a great time. Now, the tail end of the key, which they'll put their fingers on to send CW, is where we're going to drive two contact points. So we first drill the hole. There's the bottom contact point, and we'll attach wire to that one. Again, kids love this kind of stuff. They're used to working with little tiny stuff. There's going to be the top contact point, and we're going to wire it up to a 9-volt battery and a small little son alert. I know the son alert is a little tight on the sound, but the son alert does a good job, and it'll certainly blow the fog out of your ears. And we put a button or a little pebble or something where the kids would use their fingers to grasp and send CW properly, because we all know you hold the key between your thumb and your little finger. Well, make it your second finger, and that is the way we do it. Now, the CW sounders, again, are a small son alert. The little piezoelectric, the buzzer types, are too slow to come up, so use a son alert. Wire it in series with a 9-volt battery. And at Quartz Fest last year, here were the kids beginning to try the CW. First, they did the conventional method, and then the kids said, no. You got to do it with your thumb. And I go, no. You don't send CW with your thumb. That'd be like QLF. And then I realized I was out of date. Kids do everything on their texting machines with their thumb. So we quit trying to say you don't do it this way, but do it that way. Nope, we let the kids do it with their thumb, and we learn something from them. And even our ham ambassador, Dave Bell, silent key. But he even got his hand at it. He didn't get electrocuted, but he had a great time. So CW definitely lives, and we encourage all of you to put together, as Bill, KL7 Bravo Bravo, did with his Washington team, CW kits, and he actually builds it into a 100 milliwatt or even a 3-watt transmitter on 40 meters and makes some great sounds. And we encourage all of you, if you're teaching CW classes as part of our ham instructor, think about the 8 audio CDs I do for the W5YI group. Contact W5YI at 800-669-9594. Tell them you want the Gordo 8 CD pack. And they're narrated, and they're a fun way to learn CW properly. And they'll have a great time doing it. So finally, as you know, there's no more CW test as part of the exam process. In the past, we talk about clubs maybe working with the examination group to put together at their VE session club talks as well as club info. The Kings County Radio Club, Roy, AC2, Golf Sierra, says after each VE session that they conduct, they give everyone a sheet of paper with about 10 pages that says, now what? Where do we go from here? And he's got everything from the local repeaters in New York. Look at it, he's got them all listed to how to make that first call. This is wonderful. So I encourage those of you, teach a little bit of CW. Oh, no, I got to do my thumb. And you'll have a great time working new kids and adults into a new hobby of dits and daws. So, Don, that's my story. Over to you.
Awesome. I love seeing that picture that you have with Dave Bell and the Cook and Pickle. I miss Dave. Dave was a great guy and a great ambassador for amateur radio. And it always reminds me of the time you came to New Orleans and we did your stage show down there at the Jewish temple. And we did the electric pickle down there. That was a great time. That's one of my favorite memories. And, yep, Dave Bell is a silent key, and unfortunately we have another silent key in the Newsline family, which you'll hear about right now on the Amateur Radio Newsline headlines. From Amateur Radio Newsline Report number 2018, these are the Ham Nation headlines for Wednesday, July 6, 2016. Field Day is supposed to be all about emergency preparedness, extreme weather on both ends of the spectrum, from raging wildfires to torrential rains, kept radio amateurs busy with the real thing. We have team coverage.
We've all heard the horror stories about Field Day miseries. But what about when a raging wildfire forced evacuations from a site? That's what happened to the Albuquerque DX Association. Bob Norton, N5 EPA, explains.
Just way too many uncertainties. The evacuation orders were lifted only on Thursday before Field Day. When most field days start setting up on Friday, that's not a whole lot of window.
A raging wildfire was burning about 20 miles from Albuquerque. The wildfire was bearing down on the Cedro Peak Group Campground.
A couple of days after the fire started, they closed that entire ranger district down. So we reluctantly passed this year on conducting our own Field Day.
With some help from Mother Nature, firefighters were able to get the upper hand on the blaze.
Fortunately, on Wednesday and Thursday before Field Day, there were some pretty decent afternoon thunderstorms that parked right over the fireburn area, and that made an all the difference in turning around that particular fire.
In the end, all wasn't lost on this Field Day.
We had invites from other area clubs, and others just chose to stay home and operate a little Field Day from the home station.
For Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Kent Peterson, KC0DGY.
Meanwhile, in flood-ravaged West Virginia, hams awaited word of an emergency activation.
Severe storms on June 23rd caused unprecedented flooding in West Virginia, resulting in 24 deaths, with homes, businesses, entire towns being destroyed. Governor Earl Ray Tomlin declared a state of emergency in 44 of West Virginia's 55 counties. The president made a federal disaster declaration in 8 West Virginia counties. Amateur radio operators have been ready and willing to assist, but so far, communications channels remain open.
Earlier this week, WV8JS and Kanawha County ARRL Emergency Coordinator Jason Means, W8KTM, helped install an HF and VHF amateur radio station in the National Guard Charleston headquarters to be ready to provide any emergency communications which may be needed in coming days.
They want a fail-safe system, and of course we all know that the only fail-safe system in that we know about is amateur radio.
N8SFO, ARRL West Virginia Section Manager.
Some of the local areas group, we have them on standby for any help needed. Just hope that people will reach out any way they can and help out any way they can. But we need to help our neighbor.
For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Jim Dameron, N8TMW, reporting from Charleston, West Virginia.
For Brandon Nilsson, KD8ZEI, a mechanical engineering student at the University of Akron, what started as an independent study project morphed into a field day launch of another.
In his school assignment, Brandon chose a Morse code beacon weather balloon because, well, what ham can resist incorporating amateur radio into their schoolwork? He programmed an Arduino microprocessor that allowed the onboard transmitter to send in CW the words W8UPD weather balloon, bearing the call sign of the University Amateur Radio Club, of which he is president. First mission accomplished. Then came field day, and Brandon had even bigger plans. He wanted to launch another weather balloon, this one carrying a crossband repeater, which he fashioned out of two Bofong HTs. He programmed a Raspberry Pi to take photographs every 30 seconds and save them to an SD card. Then, as field day launched, so did the balloon. Brandon told Amateur Radio Newsline, quote, "I figured field day would be the best day of the year to launch since the repeater would have the most likely chance of being used with all the activity," end quote. It worked. He told us his farthest contacts were 15 miles north of Detroit, Michigan, into Ontario, and also into Warren, Pennsylvania. As for the balloon, it eventually made contact, too, with the Earth, and was located on the ground in Sugar Creek, Ohio. For Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Stephen Kinford, N8WB in Wadsworth, Ohio.
Finally this week, celebration and sadness. Newscast number 2018 begins Amateur Radio Newsline's 40th year. It was Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, who started us all off and kept it going until his death last year. Through most of that time, Dave Booth, KC6WFS, was there too. Sadly, Dave passed away June 29th. Dave and Bill were neighbors, colleagues, and best of friends. They shared a love of 6 meters, among many other things. Many times when my phone rang and Bill was on the other end of the line, he and Dave were holding high-level Newsline planning meetings in Dave's hot tub. Dave worked for Disney as a camera operator. Dave Bill and Dave Bell, W6AQ, also a recent silent key, worked together on several of the most recent ARRL ham radio films. Dave Booth was a good friend of Amateur Radio Newsline, and he will be greatly missed. And that's all from the Amateur Radio Newsline, your independent source for amateur radio news for 4 decades and counting at www.arnewsline.org. With Kent Peterson, KC0DGY, Jim Dameron, N8TMW, Stephen Kenford, N8WB, Karen Eve Murray, KD2GUT at the news desk in New York, and our news team across the globe, I'm Don Wilbanks, AE5EW. 73. We'll see you next time here on Ham Nation. And we'll have a little bit more on Dave Booth coming up this Friday on the latest edition of Amateur Radio Newsline. Dave was a great guy, longtime friend of Bill's, and I knew Bill, or knew Dave, for as long as I knew Bill. He was just a great guy, and very sad, and it's a big loss for the Newsline family. Not someone that you ever heard on the air with Newsline, but someone who was definitely behind the scenes and just a great guy. We've got another great person up now, and that is Dr. Tamitha Scove. We don't have her via videotape. We have her live. How are you, T?
I'm hanging in there. How are you guys doing?
We're doing great. Hopefully. It's nice to have you here live. So what's going on with the sun? Do we have any storms to watch out for?
Absolutely. The sun's actually been pretty quiet as of late, but that's about to change. We got this really dark finger that's been streaking across the sun, and it's actually moved now into the Earth strike zone. We also have this region right here. I don't know if you can see it fizzling and farting and popping stuff off. We had a couple mini solar storms that almost made it off the sun, but not quite from this region. And then suddenly, as this region gets a little bit further, this big coronal hole finger gets, you see that big eruption right there. Wow. That went off just not even 24 hours ago. So that And this big long finger is probably going to give us some really fast wind as well as some turbulent stuff hitting. It'll start hitting it right about now. As a matter of fact, I'll show you the AP index in just a second. You'll see a big rise in the activity level. And this is going to continue for a few days because this is driving some fast wind. And this elongated thing means it's going to probably take 3 or 4 days. So this activity might actually give you guys some disturbances through the weekend. Let me switch to your solar flux. You can see there's not a lot of activity in terms of flares. So if I switch to the solar flux levels, you've got an M flare. The M flare level is really right about here, and we've got nothing even close to that. We're almost two orders of magnitude down. So we're really not seeing a lot of activity, just a little bump right there. That was from that eruption. But we're going to continue to flatline there. So, you know, we're not getting a lot of solar flux. The bands are probably minimal propagation at best, and it's going to continue to stay that way for the indefinite period. For as far as the KP index, this is a stoplight chart. Green is good, yellow is and then red is storm level. You can see we've been really quiet over the last couple days. We finally are just beginning to pop up to what we consider unsettled conditions. This will continue here for the next, maybe 6 hours or so. And then I wouldn't be surprised if you start jumping up into active conditions. So this is definitely going to affect the ham bands. You guys are probably going to have a bigger trouble once you pass the gray line and into the night side, because that's where the disturbances actually occur. And then it will continue over the next few days, probably in through Friday, maybe even in through the weekend, depending upon whether or not we get something from that that solar storm that is missing us. Now, let me go, hold on a second while I pull up my 5 days. Okay, let me zoom in here. This is the solar storm, and hopefully you guys can read this. This is solar storm conditions and aurora possibilities over the coming week. We got it through Thursday through Monday. At high latitudes, NOAA is predicting that we will have at least minor storm conditions. Whoops, I should have made that orange. Minor storm conditions with about a 50% chance possibility of a major storm hitting, which would taper off into about a 30% chance of a minor storm into through the weekend and then tapering off even further after that. At mid-latitudes, definitely expect active conditions. We do have about a 20% possibility of a minor storm, and then that will taper off to an active and the conditions through the weekend and possibly quiet by Monday. But your weekend is looking a little bit dicey here because we already have minimal conditions as it is. You know, the solar flux is so low. So this is just going to add insult to injury.
Okay, we've got a chat room question. I know you're going to hang out through the end of the show for chat room questions, but this is a good one. Chris, KG4GSX wants to know, hey, Dr. Scove, why are we having so many sunspotless days?
The reason for that is that we are actually getting down to the solar minimum. We're not there yet. We're probably going to take another couple years or so, but we've passed through solar max, and as we come down through solar minimum, as a matter of fact, let me go back to this picture. This will help. As we go back to solar minimum, hold on, I got to figure out where my mouse is. What we see a lot less of are active regions like these bright spots, so we get a lot less flare activity, which is good from the point of view that means that you don't have any, you don't have M-class flares with radio blackouts, but bad because it means you don't have as much solar flux for decent propagation. What you do see, though, is still solar storms because we still have these fingers of coronal holes that drive fast wind. So we still do get solar storms. A lot of times they're not as bad, but we do get that. Once we get to solar minimum, these coronal holes, you'll never see them down here in the equator. You'll see them up at the poles, at the North Pole and at the South Pole. And then we're going to have no sunspots, probably no storms, maybe even for as long as a year. But that's not necessarily great because that also means the solar flux is low. So it's still going to be problematic for the ham bands.
So is that, I know these go in essentially 11-year cycles. Is this like the beginning of maybe the downside of the 11-year cycle?
It's not the beginning. We're actually kind of in the middle of the down slope. It's okay. Actually very stormy. People usually think that once you're through solar maximum, everything shuts off. And that's actually not true. It's actually a more active time during the declining phase, which is what we're in now, because these holes oftentimes come around and around. They go around the backside. They survive the backside. And 27 days later, they're back in the front wreaking havoc again. So it becomes a real kind of like pattern of pulsing the Earth's magnetic shield over and over and over again, which can cause a lot of trouble for especially for satellites. But we're about halfway through it. So expect another couple years of this, and then it just continues to, as it tapers down, and then we'll be quiet for another year or so. And then, believe it or not, things will start ramping back up again.
All right, good. Well, we just have to ride the roller coaster. That's all there is to it. Just like everything else in life, right?
That's right. Yee-yah! Yee-yah!
All right. Very good. All right. Well, you're going to stick around for the chat room later on. So people watching, get your chat room questions for Amanda. Dr. T will be back. And tell us again how we can keep in touch with you on Twitter and your website, Space Weather TV. That's still going, right?
Yes. Spaceweather.tv. It's actually undergoing a revamping right now. The best way to keep a hold of me or keep contact with me is on Twitter. My handle is at Tamitha Scove, and it's one word. You can also catch me on Facebook at Space Weather Woman. Just search for that and you'll find it. And I try to keep people posted on Facebook as well.
And Periscope, you have the same as your Twitter handle on Periscope as well, right? At Tamitha Scove?
At Tamitha Scove, right. I don't Periscope as much as I probably should right now. But people poke me on Twitter. And if there's some like a big field day that's coming up, a lot of times people can get me to jump on Periscope, but I've got a very demanding family life right at the moment. So my family's kind of like, no, you're not going on.
Exactly. Well, I'd say Twitter is the best way to stay in touch with Dr. T because she posts all the time. I remember when we had some big solar storms, you were posting like all hours of the night, and I got up like at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I think you had just gone to bed. So that was several months ago. But yeah, so check her out on Twitter at Tamitha Scove. And thank you, Dr. T. We appreciate you. She'll be back towards the end of the show for chat room. But right now, let's get a word from DX Engineering. You know, Gordon mentioned the W5YI and his CW license manuals and everything else. Well, July 1st, the FCC revised the extra class license pool. Not only was it my mother's birthday, God rest her soul, happy birthday, Mom, I love you. The FCC released their new extra class license question pool. The new pool has more questions on the latest advancements in amateur radio, notably SDR, software-defined radio, and digital technologies. That means that your old study materials will probably get you through, but they're definitely out of date, especially if you get one of those new questions on there. So it's worth your time and your while, especially if you're studying for the extra, to go ahead and get the new materials. And you can get them all at DX Engineering. They have the new updated extra class manuals in stock and ready to ship. They reflect the updated question pool. They're packed with a lot of great information. So they're a good read, even if you've already got your extra ticket. And by the way, Dr. T, I can tell you that Gordon put you and me both in the credits for one of the new manuals. I think the new extra. So we're listed in the credits. Who knew? Anyway, you can get these from the most reputable names in ham radio, like the W5YI Group and Gordon West, also the NRRL. If you're not sure what book to order, DX Engineering can recommend the best one for you. The extra class license exam just revised last week, so if your manual is not up to date, you really seriously could jeopardize your success on the extra exam. You don't want to take that twice, so get your new current July 1st book. DX Engineering also has a new product introduced. It's an all-new mast thrust bearing. Precision manufacturing, this bearing offers a much longer service life than other options. The bearings ride on a perfectly smooth surface as opposed to a metal seam, which means there's a lot less friction, there's a lot less wear, and there's a lot less slop than you'll find in other designs. And more importantly, the mast thrust bearing can handle a huge static load, enough to handle the weight of a mast and an antenna. Not only does it reduce the stress on your rotator, it means you can service your rotator without removing your mast and antenna. It saves you both time and money, and well, it's a lot safer. Using a wire antenna, I got to tell you, I love wire antennas. It's my favorite. My favorite antenna is a wire antenna. DX Engineering has new glass insulators. Well, okay, they're not exactly new. People have been using glass insulators for, you know, a century, since the dawn of radio. But these are a proven and effective way to improve the efficiency of your wire antenna, regardless of the configuration. These new DX Engineering glass insulators are designed to handle a significant amount of stress without breaking. And look at them. God, they're beautiful. They make them well-suited to most wire antenna and support rope applications. And there's a whole lot more in the latest DX Engineering catalog and online at dxengineering.com. And you know DX Engineering ships faster than anybody else in the industry. If you get your order in by 10 p.m. Eastern tonight, and if it's in stock, it'll be on a truck headed your way tonight. And most orders over $99 will get you the free standard shipping. Proven products, expert advice, DX Engineering helps you shrink the globe. I want you to go online and request your catalog, or just go ahead and shop online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at dxengineering.com/hamnation. But you really do need to get this you get this catalog because it's just full of all kinds of amazing stuff, great advice from the best and most knowledgeable hams in the business, from K3LR all the way down their tech support. These guys, if you ever have to call DX Engineering tech support, you are talking to experts, absolute ham radio experts with just decades and decades and decades of combined experience and knowledge. They've been there, they've done that, and they'll help you get to where they are. Proven products, expert advice. DX Engineering helps you shrink the globe. Request your catalog. Shop online 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. DXEngineering.com/hamnation. Thank you so much, DX Engineering, for being part of our little dog and pony show. And now let's get to, it must be ladies' night, because now it's time for Val.
Hey, it is. And you know what? Dr. T set my segment up perfectly. Because she mentioned we're going into a solar minimum. And when that happens, it's going to be a little tougher on the bands when you're working sideband. So you're going to want to make sure you get into CW and the digital mode. So I thought I'd show you guys, if anybody interested in learning CW or freshening up on their CW, here's a couple different ways that you can learn CW. So today we're going to talk about an important aspect of the hobby, and that's Morse code. And here's a little bit of history on it. It was originally called Hertzian waves because it was discovered by Heinrich Hertz back in 1886. And the first practical wireless telegraphy transmitters and receivers were developed by Marconi back in 1895. Now, Morse code is also known as CW. And for those of you who have your ticket, you should know what CW stands for. It stands for continuous wave. Now, Samuel Morse, in addition to helping invent the telegraph, also developed the code, bearing his name, Morse code. He developed Morse code back in 1838, a couple years after he developed the electric telegraph. Now, this has absolutely nothing to do with CW, but I thought it was really cool when I came across this while doing my research. Alexander Popov discovered that radio waves reflect off metal objects like ships and aircraft. And there's a photo of Sir Robert Watson Watt demonstrating one of the first radar devices for aerial objects back in 1935. But enough of history. I'm going to show you all the different ways you can learn CW, and there's a lot. Now, there's two different methods in which to learn CW. One is the Farnsworth method, and one is the Koch method. Now, the Farnsworth method, that sends characters at a fast pace, but at a slow rate, meaning that there's large spaces in between each letter, giving you lots of time to comprehend the letter. Now, the Koch method, you're going to learn at full speed, but you're only going to learn two letters. And once you master those two letters, then you're going to add another letter. And then once you master that, you add a fourth letter and keep going until you have all the letters and all the numbers and different grammatic characters memorized. And this one's really not a method, but there's also another way to learn CW, and that is using phonics. So just like people use phonics to learn how to read, it's the same principle with CW. Each letter converts to a phrase that corresponds to an image in your head, so it's a lot easier to remember. Now, each method has different pluses to it. You know, some say the Farnsworth method is better because it's more musical, or there's more rhythm to it. Whereas some say the Koch method is better because it reduces frustration because you're only learning a new letter at each time. Some say the phonics method is a really good way because you don't count the dits and the dots in your head. You hear the letters as a whole. So it's important that you try all three different ones. Maybe go online and give them all a try and see which one seems to be working best for you. And that's the one you're going to want to start going and using. So where to start? Go online. Plenty of free programs out there. The G4FON is free. Now, if you notice up in the left-hand corner, I'm going to put a K or an F or a K and F if they use either the Koch or the Farnsworth method. Also, Just Learn Morse Code is another free program that uses both Koch and Farnsworth. And my favorite online one is Learn CW Online. Now, they're all pretty similar, so just go and try out and see which ones you like. But this one's kind of cool because there's a whole introductory with a bunch of different classes. Now, this one uses the Koch method, so you're going to start off with just two letters, K and M. And you're going to keep learning what those sound like, and then you're going to practice, and it's going to play K's and M's for you. And once you get 90% or more, then you can move on to the next lesson, which will add another letter. It also has MP3s you can download, which is really cool if you guys want to put it on a USB drive. And any of those of you that have a newer car that have those USB drives in there for you to hook up your phone or your iPad to listen to music through your stereo, you can just put your USB right in there and listen to it in your car and practice, because practice is the key. So go out there and try any one of these online programs. They're all very good, and there's a whole lot more. I could spend all day talking about all the different online programs. Now, here's the phonics one we talked about, and that's called Code Quick. This is a very successful program. It is, you do have to buy it, but it's very successful. So, for example, it uses a phonics like D equals dog did it. Da did it. So it's easier to remember, and you'll picture a dog in your head when you hear the letter D. Same thing with kangaroo for K. Now, CW Ops Org, I did this class. I went from 0 to 20 words a minute in 6 weeks. Very successful. It's free. It's all volunteers from the CW Ops group, but they are booked up. If you were to sign up today, you would not even get into the January-February class coming up in 2017. You'd have to wait for the April-May class, but very effective. It uses a Skype-type thing. We used Uvu, and we had a class of 5 or 6 students and a teacher. We met online in a video chat twice a week for like an hour or so. And then he also gave us homework. And what helped make this successful for me was that we had homework to do. And since it was a classroom setting, I was really afraid of not doing my homework and not being up to the same speed as the rest of the peers in my class. So there's a little bit of peer pressure when you have a classroom setting. Now, with this, they use the Farnsworth method, and you learn it 20 words a minute. And as a matter of fact, they teach you words. So you learn the sounds of an entire word, just like you did when you were a kid. You didn't learn the alphabet first. You learned the word ball or cookie. Another very successful way to learn CW is with Gordon West's CDs. Now, I've used his CDs before when I was upgrading to Extra Class, and I tell you, they were really easy, and it helped me so much, and I passed my Extra Class on the first try. I have not tried his audio CDs for learning CW, but it has a very good success rate, and you can pick which speed you want to learn at, and you're going to get 8 CDs that you can play at work, on your computer, at home on your computer, or in your car. Now, you can also buy books. There's plenty of books out there for you to buy. ARRL has a whole bunch of them as well. Now, once you learn CW, or you're starting to learn, you're going to want to make sure you practice. You're going to want to practice every day. It's more important to practice a little bit every day than, say, 1 hour a week. You're better off doing 10 to 15 minutes every single day. That's going to be the key. And one good way to practice is with a oscillator. Now, I have one of these. It's an MFJ oscillator. They run about between $35 and $40 at your local candy store. And you can adjust the tone. You can even put headphones on that so you can practice in a quiet environment. And it's wonderful. I just keep sending my alphabet over and over and over. Or while I'm watching the news or something like that, I'll try and send some of those words. So practice is the key. Not only do you want to practice sending CW, you want to practice listening to it. And the ARRL code practice is the best way for that. They have a schedule out there on which days they have fast speed, slow speed, different bands. It's perfect. Get out there and listen to their code practice. Another cool tool for listening to CW and practicing is called Morse Runner. A lot of contesters do this, or de-expeditioners, because it's going to give you more real-life scenarios. You're going to have pileups to deal with and all different elements, just like you were in a contest. Now, there's also plenty of CW apps for your phone. Now, this is Morse Runner through the Google Play Store. Now, this one's kind of fun because it's a jump-and-play video game that uses CW. So you're not only going to practice your CW, you're going to have fun playing the game. Now, this is something that you might want to use to get your grandkids or your kids involved in learning CW. So as you can see, there's a lot of different apps out there that you can get for your phone that utilizes the different methods that you prefer. And so you can get out there and practice from your smartphone. So all kinds of different ways to learn CW. So hopefully you guys will get out there and do that. Here's my little oscillator. that I used when I learned. They taught us at CW Ops Group on a straight key, and then you just convert to a paddle when you're done. But this also becomes our multiplier key when we're in a contest. We hit that button when we work a multiplier. And speaking of contests, this weekend is the IARU HF Championship. And what that is you're going to want to try and work people in different zones and in the different ITU zones. And there's the ITU zones there. Each person you work in a different ITU zone, or each ITU zone is a multiplier. Now, if you work somebody in the same ITU zone as you, doesn't matter if it's in a different country or your own continent, it's 1 point. If you work anyone in the same continent but a different ITU zone, then they're worth 3 points. And if you work somebody in a different continent and a different ITU zone, that's going to be worth 5 points. So that's going to be your multipliers there. There's 75 possible, and you can take that down, Brian. And then other multipliers besides the 70 some ITU zones, there's about 153 HQ or different administrative councils and regional executive committee members and things like that. Now, there's some of them end in HQ. If you see a station that ends in HQ, that's going to be a multiplier for you. But not all of them end in HQ. ARRL, every year, they pick one station to represent Whiskey One Alpha Whiskey as the ARRL. And this year, they picked Whiskey One Alpha Whiskey Portable 9. And they picked our station and Craig's station. So we're going to be a multiplier. We're going to be Whiskey One Alpha Whiskey Portable 9 doing all the sideband from here. And K9CT is going to be Whiskey One Alpha Whiskey Portable 9 doing all the CW. This is a CW and sideband contest. Also, they pick one other station in the U.S. to be the their IARU station. And that's going to be NU1 Alpha Whiskey Portable 6. Is where they pick that, and N6RO is going to be hosting that most of the band slots on that, along with Whiskey 6 Yankee X-Ray. So you can get out there and work those 153 multipliers, and if you can get all those zones, that's a lot of multipliers. But it's really nice because you can work U.S., you can work and around the world. So it's not one of those contests where you can only work other countries. You can work everybody. So, and you can do CW or phone. So get out there and do that this weekend and work us Whiskey One Alpha Whiskey Portable 9. We got 6 operators. We're going to have 2 full-time stations. First time we've ever had 2 full-time stations. Hopefully we don't trip the circuit breakers. I don't think we've had 2 amps going full-time. Also want to mention K0HS. That's an amateur radio club up near Mount Rushmore. They're going to be operating from Wind Cave at Custer National Park. They're going to be on the air July 7th and 8th. And by the way, the IARU I didn't mention is this Saturday, 7 a.m. Central or 1200 UTC. It only runs 24 hours. So it's a really quick contest. So hopefully I'll work you guys on the air. And that's all I've got for this week. So let's hear it now from ICOM America.
Get out there and get on the air. Combine your recreational enjoyment this summer of amateur radio with the great outdoors. Join the National Parks on the Air event and celebrate our national parks turning 100 years young. Just be sure your ICOM equipment is ready for action. See how ICOM is changing the way receivers are being designed with ICOM's new IC7300. It will exceed expectations. RF direct sampling, 15 discrete bandpass filters, large 4.3-inch color touchscreen, real-time spectrum scope, and SD memory card slot. Limited space is no problem with the IC7100 base station. It's a great compact D-Star option. Angled control head and touchscreen for quick intuitive operation, large internal speaker for clear digital audio, and it's perfect for multi-band and all-mode communications. Simplified operation, HF, and digital technology, the IC718 base station is the most practical rig you will ever own. Front-mounted loudspeaker, DSP capability, selectable antenna tuner, and simple operation. Visit icomamerica.com/amateur for more information on all ICOM radios. And you can tune in and enter to win after each episode of Ham Nation. Go to icomamerica.com/hamnation and register to win some great swag prizes like hats and t-shirts. And while you're there, learn how you could be registered to win the monthly grand prize drawing for radio. And for June, we have a winner, and that was Lynn, KD9GHY. He won an ICOM ID5100A, and we've got another one we're going to give away in July. It's a dual-band, dual-watch VHF-UHF transceiver with touchscreen, analog and D-Star, internal GPS, DV and FM repeater list function, available Bluetooth unit and headset, Android app, and a lot more. So go to icomamerica.com/hamnation and register to win. You could be next week's lucky winner. Sign up, good luck, and don't forget to follow ICOM America, Inc. on Facebook and Twitter. Well, right now I've got just a little video clip that I shot at Field Day. This is a portion of clips I'm still working on that we'll be releasing soon. This is the antennas that the group I was with, the Amateur Logic crew and a couple of friends there, put together this year. Here's the antenna I'm going to use this year. It's an MFJ 43-foot telescopic fiberglass mast. I've got it on an old TV-type tripod. Just kind of tied it on there to hold it supported. The thing is super lightweight. One person can easily handle it. You could even take it and lean it over with no problems at all. The very top section of it's about the size that you'd expect on a rod and reel. I'm just using this as a vertical for 20, 40, I believe 15 and 10. And what I did is I cut ground radials, two radials for each of those bands, and I've laid them on the ground. What I did for the radiating element is took a piece of wire and cut it for 40 meters, and then I cut that wire into segments for each of the other three bands that I wanted to work. And I put a little wire connectors right there where I can pull it apart and just use however many sections of the correct length for whatever band I want to operate on. It's ugly, but I think it's going to work pretty good. You can see right there at the bottom, I've just got an SO239, and everything's just kind of screwed together and laying on the ground. Initial tests with the antenna analyzer showed that everything tuned up good. It's not super far away from Wayne's off-center fed. You can see where it crosses it. The vertical's a little bit lower than that horizontal dipole up there, and probably about 10 feet downhill from it. So hopefully we won't get too much interference there. And this is the hay field. They recently cut hay here, so grass is not super tall. We used the same site that we had last year and had to do very little cleanup on it. Tommy finally made it. He's over there putting his MFJ, I think it's an MFJ vertical, together. He brought it last year, but when he started assembling it, he dropped a screw immediately and lost it, so we didn't use it last year, but he's going to use it this year. It's a multi-band. I'm not sure what all it covers. There's another piece of it on the ground over there. We'll have to see how that works out. We've got about 45 more minutes before field day officially begins. I think we'll actually make it this year. I'm not sure all stations will be on the air, but some of them will. And here goes the ceremonial raising of the vertical.
Oh, there's one more section to go up under it. Wayne is telling Tommy which way the antenna should point.
Man, that thing looks like antennas off a bug.
Off a bug?
Yeah.
Oh, what?
Yeah.
It looks like antennae.
Yeah.
Now, currently, Vince is on this Outbacker outpost that Wayne built some time ago. It's got his Outbacker antenna on it. And you probably can't see it, but there's legs that fold out, sort of act as a counterpoise there on it. Wayne is going to be, and you probably can't see it. There's a wire up there connected to that bell, and that's one end of a 80-meter off-center fed dipole. The other end goes over into the top of a tree. It's the antennas we used this year. For rigs, we had three of these IC7300s. They worked really nice, but I think we probably talked about that last week. I've got more footage from our adventures out in the woods for field day, and we are planning on shooting that or putting that together Friday night, 8 p.m. Central at live.amateurlogic.tv. Join us over there and kind of relive some of the memories. It was a lot of fun this year. We did things a lot like we always do, which most of you have seen before, but we had some new things going on as well. Well, you know, last week I asked a question, what did you do for field day? And had a lot of good answers on that. Of course, the random drawing winner can only be one person, and that is N9QLQ. Let me say that again, N9QLQ. Rich Ard. He says, I enjoyed trying out my new IC7300. And I'm sure you did, Rich. So we're going to send you 12 feet of a DX Engineering RG8X coaxial cable with the DX Engineering exclusive crimped on silver plated connectors. A great heavy duty patch cord there. For next week, we've got another prize that we're going to be giving away. That's going to be an MFJ 148RC. It's a dual 12/24-hour large digit clock with a radio control time sync and a 10-minute ID timer. What we're going to want to know next week is what was the wavelength of that vertical antenna that I built and used for field day? You can send your answer to me, hamnationcontest@gmail.com. This thing will be going off in 10 minutes now, if you heard that beep there. hamnationcontest@gmail.com, and you could be registered for next week's prize. Now, I got a few other really good entries here. I just wanted to read off just a quick few of them here. I couldn't read them all. There were too many of it. But Scott N7JI said that he is from Oregon, but he was working in West Virginia over the past 2 weeks. And he didn't know what he'd be able to do for field day. So he took his portable FT-817 station with him in a suitcase. He set up a portable station in the hotel parking lot with his super antenna MP-1. He had a portable vertical and his trusty rig, and he made 29 QSOs, mostly on 20-meter CW, and he said he managed to operate for about 90 minutes before the mosquitoes started biting. Also, Mylan into NYU, this was great. He says, this was my first field day, and it was very interesting and educational. He said he came to help set up in the morning on Saturday and ended up staying 24 hours and operating throughout the day and night. It was really exciting to him. The other club members showed him the information how to exchange it for field day, how to use the different rigs, and how to log his contacts. He operated on 20, 40, and 80. On three different radios, he made 97 contacts on his first field day. He said he was really amazed to hear an LZ station from Bulgaria, which is where he was born, and he really got hooked on ham radio that day, so he just bought his first all-mode, all-band HF radio. That was great to hear, too. I also heard from Marv, WA7MLD, and he said he had every intent to go out and work portable, but alas, he had to stay home and fix a plumbing leak. And I got just one more, and this one, I think this guy is friends with Val and Jerry, but he had an interesting story here. This is Curtis, KD0HIY. No, he's friends, I think, with Amanda and Jeff. Amanda can tell us about that in a minute. He said things were going well when he pulled up in his local park at 7 a.m., this is what they've been planning for. First order business was to put up a 20 by 20 tent that they would be operating. Next, the antennas, the table, the radio, the solar, et cetera. And they were on the air by 1800 UTC. He manned the GOTA station and helped two new techs make 18 contacts with an IC718 running barefoot with a G5 RV. Since they had decided to run 1A, they took turns working phone and CW, and it seemed like field day 2016 would be a great one. Then came the storm. It said clouds had been building throughout the afternoon, and at about 2100, thunder crashed. They quickly disconnected their coaxes and sheltered under the tent, hoping the storm would pass by with little activity. The heavy rain actually seemed to be a blessing as it dropped the temperature, made it a little more bearable. But then they learned the biggest mistake. They had relied on solar power to keep the batteries out of the graveyard, and they should have been using wind. The gentle breeze turned into a gusting wind, and their wonderful tent began to try and relocate itself. For about an hour, five men tried to defy the powerful wind. They managed to keep the tent in about the same place while buckets of rain fell and gust after gust threatened to take it out. He said it was all over about as fast as it started. He glanced around in the tent and saw a rope had broken in the wind, and he quickly went outside to fix the problem just as he finished the repair. He saw a tent side bulge in his direction, and he yelled, "The wind's changed direction." And as he finished that statement, the tent took flight. He tried to run, but found himself body slammed in the wet grass and unable to move as a tent, frame and all, pinned him to the ground like a supermarket steak on a styrofoam. One of the men acting as a live tent stake had used a brief period of calm to go to the restroom. When he made his back or his way back, he asked the guys, "Did y'all take the tent down?" And Curtis says that he slithered out from under the tent and declared field day is over. So Curtis, quite a field day adventure there. Thanks for sharing it with us. Well, now I think it's time that we get Amanda in here, see what's going on in the chat room and what kind of questions they've got for Dr. Scove tonight.
Oh, we have some great questions for Dr. T for sure. And I just have to comment on Curtis. By the way, you guys, when you hear this story over the repeater from your good friends, Curtis and Neil and a lot of other Pueblo West Ham Club members, it was so much more dramatic than he just represented it to you guys. It was bodies were flailing as we were holding the canopy down and the tent was flying. Sorry, it was, they made it sound so much more dramatic. Okay, that's all I have to say about that. They didn't win any points for the safety officer this year, I think. Dr. T, it's so nice to have you with us. How are you doing tonight?
Pretty good, thanks. How are you guys doing?
Very wonderful, actually.
Getting my son moving again here, so just in case, just to make it look a little bit more lively.
There you go.
I don't have tents knocking over, but...
Speaking of the sun, and we see the color purple in the sun, the first question comes from Marty, 80PO, and his wife, KE0EWK. They want to know, how come sometimes you view the sun in purples? How come sometimes in red, yellow, other colors? What do the colors mean anything? Explain it to us.
Absolutely. The colors are very dramatic, and the reason why I'm showing a purple sun today is because it shows these big dark coronal holes. And I should have pulled up, if I had known this question was coming, I would have pulled up another picture of the sun in a different color. If I were to pull this same picture, the same movie up in a different color, let's say red, for instance, you would not see this dark spot at all. All you would see would be kind of like a fuzzy area, but it would be exactly the same color. And the reason for this is that these are false color images. Obviously, the sun really isn't purple or red or green or anything like that. But what it does is that it gives us scientists kind of a know that, okay, this is a particular wavelength of light. And what that corresponds to is a temperature. So this is, I mean, it probably doesn't matter to anyone, but this is 211 angstroms. That's what we're actually looking at when we're looking at this particular purple color. Now, what that tells us is that we're looking at a certain temperature in the corona and in what we call the chromosphere. This is a certain layer, kind of layer in the altitude, or at a certain altitude in the sun's atmosphere. If we look really high up, kind of like where we are now, you'll see these dark, cold regions, and that's why they're black. Is because they don't have any color in, or they don't have any energy in the wavelength that we're looking at. That's why they appear like they're holes. They're not really holes. They're just cold areas. When you image it in a different wavelength, these holes disappear. But if you want to look at where fast wind is coming from and where these solar storms are going to, you know, be generated from, you'll want to look at it in this particular wavelength. Now, if I were to switch to red, it actually is a lower wavelength, and that's closer to the surface of the sun. And that wavelength actually shows the big majestic like ejections. You see that oftentimes these things that when it erupts, you actually see material kind of jetting off and coming towards you or moving off the edge of the sun, and it's just spectacular. That's the wavelength that you look at it in that. It's 304 angstroms, and that's the red sun. If you want to see big flare regions and big pops like paparazzi light bulbs, you look at the blue sun, because that's the hottest area, and it shows the brightest part of these active regions. But it doesn't really show coronal holes very well, and it doesn't show big massive ejections, because it's the wrong color. It's the wrong wavelength and the wrong altitude of the solar atmosphere. So hopefully, in a nutshell, that kind of gives you an idea why we have so many colors of the sun.
Absolutely. I completely understand now. Very interesting, actually. I have seen it, you know, some space weather stuff and seeing it in red and yellows before. Now I know I only want to see yellow and I want to see those big sunspots for us. Anyhow, another question we have for you is, you're brilliant in predicting how the bands are going to be for ham radio operators, but what do you actually do for a living? How do I explain this? Why are you into space weather?
Why do I do what I do? Well, I tell people what my day job is I actually help NASA, NOAA, and other government agencies learn to understand the effects of space weather and how it affects the space assets, not only that are traveling to other planets, like, for instance, Juno, which just arrived. I don't know if you guys know it did an orbit insertion on July 4th. But I actually helped did the radiation analysis for that particular spacecraft, because you worry about its solar panels degrading in the Jovian environment. So I do that for planetary stuff, but I also do it for Earth-based assets, because I work in a government think tank, and it's part of our job to help the Air Force make sure that all of the satellites that are doing our communications and doing our entertainment and predicting our weather and looking down at Earth and trying to help keep us informed of what's going on. All of those space assets basically need to be able to run 24/7. And so if something's going to happen in space that causes anomalies or causes a satellite to not be able to communicate or reach the ground or have signal propagation issues, just like ham radio, I have to be able to tell these guys, okay, this is what's going to happen, when and why. And then I also help them design better satellites that can weather these storms and not have to worry about shutting down or having these anomalies that then they have to figure out how to, you know, overcome. So that's my day job. But what I like doing for you guys is kind of sharing that knowledge in a public forum so that you can become better aware. And as space tourism becomes a bigger deal, people will know, let's say, when to take the balloon up into space so that they can watch aurora, stuff like that.
Very cool. I had no idea what your background was, and I think that's awesome. And thank you for being such a great role model in science for women, of course. And another question I have, you have a huge amount of energy. I follow you on Twitter, and I'll see you at 2 a.m. retweeting all of these aurora shots and everything else. So is this also kind of a hobby and just kind of an excitement of seeing all the auroras around the world, stuff like that?
This has become a passion, and no, I'm not. I mean, I'm energetic. I'll take the time to be energetic when there's a particular storm going on and there's a lot of aurora. There are a lot of what I call field reporters, both ham radio and aurora, and also GPS operators that I rely on to tell me how conditions are in their local area. When I tweet or retweet these reports, then it lets other people in those areas know to go out and look, or, hey, there's going to be problems or stuff like that. So that's why I always bow to the ham radio ops when you guys report into me and let me know what band conditions are, so that other people aren't climbing up on their rigs going, what's wrong with my antenna? You know, they know that it's really beyond their control what's happening. So I do stay up a lot of times overnight, at least as long as I can keep my eyes open, and then I hand it off to other people. But it's I'm really trying to build a community of people who are in the know with space weather, because this really is the weather of the 21st century, and it's going to continue to become even more important for us, especially as we continue to build more and more spacecraft and we become more and more reliant with our technologies on the space environment.
Absolutely. Well, we appreciate all of your hard work, that's for sure. We love hearing your reports every week. And Don, did you have any questions you'd like to add in there?
I'm seeing a couple in the chat room that I wanted to pick up. Someone asked if we're actually safe passing through the Van Allen radiation belts and what protection the Apollo astronauts had during their lunar missions. And someone else wanted to know, and I think I know the answer to this question, does Dr. T support women in tech? Which, of course, that is a resounding yes. But tell us about the Van Allen radiation belts and the effects or the protection that the Apollo astronauts had to have going to the moon.
Okay, well, first of all, the Van Allen belts, they're generated by the Earth's magnetic field. If we didn't have that magnetic shield, you know, it's the same magnetic field that you read here on the ground with a compass, it extends up into space, and it actually protects us to a great degree from the onslaught of the solar wind. But the consequence of that is we kind of have like a particle accelerator in Earth orbit. It kind of looks like a big donut that wraps around the Earth with the donut fingers going to the North Pole and then the bottom going to the South Pole. So it kind of wraps around like this, if that makes any sense. And inside that donut in the toroid is where we get the particle acceleration. So that's where the Van Allen belts are created. And that region is really only about anywhere between 4 to about 6 Earth radii out into space. So, we actually have spacecraft that traverse this area all the time. All our geosynchronous satellites actually sit right out just on the outside edge of what we call the outer zone, which is the outer part of the outer radiation belt. The ISS, where the astronauts are, they actually skirt the inner zone all the time. So they're actually kind of passing through the inner portion of the inner radiation belt, which we also know as the South Atlantic Anomaly. That's actually just kind of like catching the edge of part of that inner radiation belt. So the astronauts have to deal with this, not just going to the moon, but they have to deal with this on a daily basis. And these belts fluctuate because the magnetic field fluctuates. It bounces and things, and these belts are kind of tied to that magnetic field. It's got to stay inside that donut. So it's a very dynamic place, and it's very hard to understand. But what we try to do is we try to make sure that when there is a big geomagnetic storm, or when there's even a big solar storm from the sun, a big radiation storm, we don't have the astronauts out, and we don't try to have anything where the astronauts are flying through the harshest parts of the radiation belt. But it does happen, because we can't always predict when these storms are going to occur. So we get them to hide under the bulkheads. They close their eyes. They see fireworks in their retinas because of the particles that are impinging on their eyes. And then they just deal with it. And then when they go home, they, you know, take off their radiation badge, because they are called radiation workers, by the way. And they have to deal with it. But it's not much different, strangely enough. It's not much different than airline crew, both pilots and the airline crew. They are also called radiation workers because they have galactic cosmic rays that come and penetrate when you're flying at high altitudes. So they see a bigger dose of radiation that's also considered space weather. So it's not just the astronauts that have to worry about being radiation workers and being radiation safe, at the astronauts and anybody who's flying at high altitudes and high latitudes. So even passengers on long duration flights, let's say over the poles or transatlantic or something like that. If you're a high risk passenger, like say in chemotherapy or under radiation therapy or something like that, or, you know, maybe a pregnant woman, oftentimes when there's a radiation storm, I say, you know, please take this stuff into consideration in your flight plans. So it does affect all of us.
Very interesting. I guess we all thought that the Van Allen radiation belts would be so much farther away, like maybe closer to the moon, halfway out or something. But it is. It's very close, relatively to the Earth. And I was not aware that the ISS basically skirted the inside. That's interesting. Okay. One final question. What exactly is your specific field of science? What did you go to school for, and your doctorate is in exactly what? Is it, are you a solar physicist? Are you a planetary physicist? Are you, what exactly is your doctorate in?
I have a very strange doctorate. Not too many people know about this. It's an earth science, and it kind of skirts the line between being astrophysics and being a geophysicist. It's called geophysics and planetary physics. That's what I got both my master's and my PhD in. And then I also have a bachelor in just straight physics and also physical chemistry. So I've got a kind of a hodgepodge of everything. Now, my special discipline is called space plasma physics. And that's basically everything from essentially the surface of the sun all the way to where that solar wind and the transients and all that stuff in space hits the planets and interacts with the planets and causes space weather. So that's here at Earth, that's at Mercury, Mars, basically anything in the solar system we can send a satellite to. I am not a cosmologist like Stephen Hawking. I am not an astrophysicist or an astronomer. I actually like the space that we can actually send stuff to, send, you know, payloads to, that we can actually take measurements of and, you know, write in it, you know, say what we call in situ measurements. Those are very, very important because they give us a quantitative understanding of these types of phenomena. Whereas if you're just an astrophysicist or an astronomer or even a solar physicist, all you can do is look and get pictures, but it's really hard to make quantitative measurements because you're not quite there. You're just looking from far away. We call that remote sensing. And that kind of physics is a lot harder to do.
Well, I got to tell you, I find the whole thing fascinating. And one final comment from the chat room, Jeff, K8JTK, he echoes my thoughts as well. His comment is, Dr. T is one of my favorite parts of the show. And I know that there are a lot of viewers who are now following you because of Ham Nation, and they feel the same way. I feel the same way. I learned something new every time you're on, and having you here live is a special treat, and I certainly hope we can make this a regular occurrence. So thank you so much for being here live with us tonight and for fielding questions in the chat room. I know that we've all learned so much more tonight than we ever thought that we would, and we look forward to the next time you're here with us live.
And I have a couple questions too. Two more questions. I promise they're going to be, well, maybe they'll be quick. First, Dr. T, like meteorologists use so many tools to predict the weather, what kind of tools do you use to predict space weather?
Most of the stuff that we use is data from satellites. We use pictures like this. This is SDO. This is the AIA instrument, what we call the Atmospheric Imaging Assembly aboard SDO. It's actually got four big telescope cannons that sit right on top of this thing. It makes it look like a big battleship tank kind of thing. And we use those with all the different colors to be able to see all the different layers of the atmosphere to give us a better idea when things are lifting off. We also do have models that have been what we call research to operations. NOAA, the Space Weather Prediction Center, is in charge of taking these models from the research field, basically the academic field, and migrating them to what we call an operational thing where they're actually being used 24/7 as a monitor. We also have ground magnetometers that helps us understand things like what the currents are doing, what the aurora would be doing, what the electrojets are doing, which then tells us about geomagnetically induced currents that cause power grid failures and can cause charging of like ham radio antennas, that type of thing, also causes problems for GPS. So we have an arsenal of both models and data that we use to help do these predictions. But this field is still incredibly new. The analog is like what terrestrial weather was back in the 60s, where basically you had a tornado warning. That's pretty much all you had. And you have a big siren and everybody would panic and go, oh my God, the sky is falling kind of thing. And and really that's a lot of what we have today. And you see a lot of that in some of these reports of the Carrington event and it's going to send us back to the dark ages. It's really a lot of that same analog. And I am working with the American Meteorological Society right now to combat that, to try to bring people back into a rational state of mind that space weather is here, it's real, and we can treat it just like we treat terrestrial meteorology. We just have to develop the field more and put the money and the time and the effort into understanding it.
Wow. So you're a pioneer. That's so awesome. And yeah. My last question, and you had to expect this one. When are you getting your dang ham license, lady?
I know. It's terrible. It's terrible.
I had to ask. I'm sorry.
Yes, and you're not the first person to zing me on that, too. So, yes, I have a few. If I were to take my shirt off a little bit, you'd see all the welts I have from other people who have been dinging me for it. So, yes, I know I am overdue. And I've already seen a couple. I have taken some practice exams, and I've actually done pretty well. So I just have to get my courage up to take the real thing, at least for my tech license.
You'll do an excellent job. I have no worries whatsoever. So anyhow, thank you so much for joining us. I'll send it back over to Don.
And I'll send it back up to George because we've gone way over time tonight, but it's been worth every second for the knowledge that we've gotten from Dr. T. George, anything you have to add tonight?
Well, I did have one question and I actually had two, but I'm only going to ask one because I think the one about the smoked glass is probably not valid. But I read a post on the internet somewhere within the past week. Somebody was making the prediction, and they sounded like maybe they were an expert or a so-called expert, but I didn't really believe the story. They said that, the reason this sunspot cycle has been so weak is because the sun is going into another phase and it's on the downhill slope now and it's burning out. Any truth to any of that?
Well, the sun is in a different phase. That's true. We think it's more similar to what's called a Dalton minimum. This is when the sun has actually gone into kind of a period where it's had several cycles that were much lower than normal. As a matter of fact, this cycle that we're in is actually stretched out the typical 11-year cycle. It's actually stretched out to about 14 years. And that's not uncommon when the activity cycles aren't as violent and active, they actually get longer. And when they're more violent and more active, they actually get shorter. So there's like this special magic, this balance that the sun plays. And the sad thing that we scientists have to endure is the fact that we don't really have very much data in what we call the space age relative to the sun's timeline. A solar cycle is 10 or 11 years. We've only been active in space for about 50. So that means we have only about five cycles of the sun to really go by. Now, there's proxies that take us back, you know, way back to the ice age, but we have to dig up ice cores and everything else, and it's hard to calibrate those. So we don't really know all that much about the sun. The only time we've ever seen a Dalton minimum was back in the 1800s, and that was similar to this cycle here. The River Thames froze. There were a lot of people that ended up dying. I don't think we're going to see that. Let me wake the TV back up here. Hold on. I don't think we're going to see that this particular cycle, if no other reason than because of climate change. But that we really don't know whether or not this is kind of going to get even quieter. We don't think so anymore. But some people are still thinking that this could go into what we call a Maunder minimum, which is we've also only seen one time. And the Maunder minimum was when we called it a little ice age, where we actually went spotless on the sun for something like 80 years or something. It was a very long period of time. And that was because the sun really shut down. Now, luckily, what we've seen already is there's some polar flows of plasma that we look underneath the sun's surface. And we've seen those polar flows going back up to the North Pole. And that's where the sunspots will emerge. They'll emerge in the North Pole and the South Pole for the new cycle. If we did not see those flows, we would be really worried right now. But we do see those flows. So we do know the new cycle is coming. It just may take a little bit longer than anticipated. But yes, there is a lot of speculation, even on scientists, even from a scientist's point of view, because we just don't have enough data. Human beings just haven't gotten technologically advanced enough relative to how long it takes for the sun to do its thing. So we're trying, but, you know, take everything you hear with a grain of salt.
Well, that was kind of my thought is, from our perspective, we really haven't seen much. Sun's been around a lot longer. Well, we appreciate you being with us here tonight. It's been real interesting. You know, we all rely, a lot of us rely on the sun to help our communications. Some hams know more about it than others, but that doesn't change how much we rely on it and how it's going to affect our propagation. And we appreciate you being here to kind of explain it to us and give us a better idea of how this all fits together. And there's nothing we can do to change it, but at least we can understand it a little bit better and know how to take advantage of it and, work through some of the conditions that we could face. Well, we're looking forward to you getting your ham license and joining us on the air. But in the meantime, come back whenever you can.
Thank you so much. And it's a pleasure to be talking with you amateur radio ops, because you guys instinctively know how the sun works. And it's just so wonderful to be able to talk with you without, having to explain things to such a level that where people, because most people they're not even aware of the sun. They think it's just a light bulb in the sky. And all of you are much more savvy than that. And it's just an absolute pleasure to field questions and help you guys get even a deeper understanding of how space weather and the sun affects you. So thank you for letting me on.
All right. Well, thanks. And thanks you all for joining us this week. Another great episode. We'll be back next week, and Bob will be back with us. And boy, who knows what we'll get into then. So 73 from Jackson, Mississippi. Don, any final words from down south?
No, just a quick note on the nets, 14282 on 20, 7202 on 40. Of course, the D-Star on 14 Charlie and the Echo Link on 355-800. And somebody asked a question in the chat room, what is it that's inside the sun that makes it so hot? And somebody else answered the question for us, probably not one of Dr. T's colleagues. The answer was sriracha. It's probably not right, but yeah, it works for me. George?
You should try putting some on your spark plug wires, Don. That's
a good idea.
Might be the trick there. Amanda, I wanted to tell you, yes, my reading of Curtis's story was not even as dramatic as it was printed on paper here. So I could imagine hearing it over the repeater.
Put some action in there. Make us feel bad for the guys. I didn't feel bad. Right. Did you guys feel bad on the chat room? No.
Well, like I say, it read a lot better in the head than it did through the microphone. So,
welcome to my
world, George. I'm glad you shared that.
Yep. Well, Amanda, any final words from there?
Hey, guys. I just hope to hear you guys on the air tonight on the net.
Okay. All right. See y'all next week, 7-3.
Good night, everyone.
Bye.
Anything from Dr. T is really neat.
Yeah, it's gold.
Absolutely. She's absolutely fabulous. So you're doing a great job. Thank you so much for your help in the ham radio. That's for sure.
Oh, absolutely. And thank you guys so much for all the airtime. I mean, you know, you really allowed me to answer a lot of questions, and I really appreciate that. Anything I can do to get space weather out there. And you know, I do consider the ham radio ops. You guys are the front runners. You know, the Aurora photographers, they help a lot, but they don't understand propagation at all. And propagation is key for satellite signals, you know, amateur radio, obviously, but also for GPS. And, you know, that's a huge part of the game. So, you know, I really bow to you guys. And I appreciate you so much that you guys let me take even a corner of the show every now and again. So thank you.
Yeah, you know, we hope to make your live appearances, hopefully something regular, like we talked about on private message earlier today, maybe once a month or something like that. And
that'd be cool.
Continue with the videos. But yeah, anytime you have time to come on live, this is awesome.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, I would love to. Yeah, sorry, George.
Yeah. There's one more thing that I should have asked you earlier. And that's, I think it's a misnomer, and my understanding of it is not that great. But, you know, and Don can relate to this, working with satellites, we have certain seasons that we have sunspot fades on the satellites, and we lose signals for our broadcast networks or whatever. Now, if you could just really briefly tell me, when we say we're having a sunspot fade, that doesn't mean there's a lot of sunspots up there, does it? Just that the our dish is focused perfectly at the sun, and it's just amplified so much that we're getting interference?
Most likely. I mean, if it's not flare-related, definitely. If it's a flare, obviously, you know, that's something else. But if it's just near an active region, you definitely do get a focused sense, because the active region is, or sunspot, we call it active regions a lot, because sunspot oftentimes doesn't explain everything of what that region does. Mm. And, you know, because a sunspot can also release an ejection like this one. This is a plage region. It's actually kind of a dead sunspot, but you can see it's still quite active, and it does actually release right there. And another one, it releases these storms. So when it does that, it's actually flaring a little bit, and I don't have the right color, but that's kind of what sunspots do all the time, is they're always kind of flaring just a smidge. So when you get to that region where you're actually passing through it, as the sun is rotating, or the sunspot is rotating past your field of view, then yes, you're going to get a peak in solar flux. If there happens to be a low B-class flare or something like that going on at the time, you'll get even more of a peak. And so your fade may not even be consistent, because that sunspot is actually changing its activity, you know, all the time. It's kind of pulsing in an irregular fashion. So you may have a fade that kind of starts out strong and then dies, and then comes back and dies. And then, you know, but there's kind of this pattern that shows a fade, and then it disappears. And yes, that's directly due to how you're passing right through that intense area of that region.
Yeah. I think we're using the wrong term for it in our industry, because they call it a sunspot fade, but they give us predictions. They say, okay, this month, this particular day, between these hours, you're going to have a sunspot fade on your satellite on our network. But, you know, I don't think they can predict that far in advance, you know, what's going to be on the sun at that point. But if you look out there at the dish, you know, there's a feed horn right in the center of it. You'll see the shadow perfectly get in the center of the dish when it fades out. So I'm thinking, since they're predicting it so far in advance, they can't really say it's sunspots, just that it's the sun.
That's possibly true, and I have not looked to a great degree at the type of predictions and how far in advance they make them. We do have satellites that are looking at the backside of the sun, and these sunspots oftentimes or active regions rather, they stay for a long period of time and they don't really migrate. I mean, they migrate as the sun rotates, but the rotation of the sun is very predictable. So we know from one place, how long, if a sunspot shows up on the east limb, how long it's going to take before it's over on the west limb. And we could pretty much track where it's going to be at any one time, at least on the Earth-facing disk. And then on the backside, if it's a stable region, then yeah, we can actually predict, 2 weeks in advance easily. Maybe some predictions can even go 30 days in advance as to where a sunspot might be. If it survives its the rotation around the backside and comes back. We do that a lot with coronal holes as well. So there are certain things that we can predict. What we can't predict are things like flares and solar storms. Those are, look, there's something happening. We can say that the potential is higher, but we can't say for certain when something's going to happen. And that's the funny thing about space weather and what I'm doing is that as I get more people educated in what space weather is and what we can do well and what we can't, it does expose the limitations. And I've had more than a few people come to me who said, I go to NOAA's website and they say for sure all this is going to happen. And they're wrong on everything because I'm paying attention now and I know that their predictions really aren't coming to fruition. And it's like, I say, yeah, well... This is good and bad. it advances the field, but it also exposes my colleagues. So, I'm a little bit torn, but we've got to do something to get the field, to bring the field out of the dark ages and into the future.
Yeah, George, well, I just had a thought. I bet it would be interesting for both us as broadcasters, you and I, and also for Dr. Scove, when you get those emails with the solar outage predictions, forward those to her so she can kind of look at those and see when those are expected and maybe do a little bit more research and maybe see how that correlates with what's happening on the sun. I bet that would be interesting.
Yeah, I may be using the wrong term, but I've always heard it called sunspots, but I they're predicting them so far in advance. I don't see how it could be. Well, thanks for clearing up a lot of mystery for us, Dr. T. And it sounds kind of like predicting the weather.
Yes, exactly. Very, very true. And, and that's what I'm trying to do. So keep your fingers crossed, because I'll let you in on a little insider info. I've been working with the president-elect of the AMS to create a space weather AMS meteorological broadcast and consulting like seal. How they have those big seals that say, okay, this is a certified broadcaster on the AMS, kind of like having the American Dental Association, say your toothpaste is okay. This is the same thing, but for space weather, scientists. So I'm working to get that certification done, because if we can do that, then it'll make it a lot easier for, the people who are pedigreed and skilled in this type of stuff to actually get an audience and be trusted and have the crazy conspiracy theorists that just drive us all nuts and who are wrong more often than they're right, kind of push those guys aside and be able to ignore them. So keep your fingers crossed, because this is something that's going to happen probably over the next couple of years if all works out well.
Cool.
Good deal.
Yeah. Thank you. Much appreciated.